The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
And welcome back to Scarred for Life, the podcast where we open up old wounds by looking back at the films that scared us as kids. I'm Terry.
And I'm Mary Beth.
In each episode, our special guest brings with them a movie that traumatized them as a child.
This week, our guest is author Daniel Krause. He is a New York Times bestselling writer of novels, TV, and film, including The Living Dead and the novelization of The Shape of Water. His latest novel, Whalefall, destroyed both me and Terry, and is available now. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you.
Hello.
I've been dying to talk with you about Whalefall since I read it earlier this summer. But for our listeners that might not be aware of it, can you kind of give us a little bit of what it's about?
Sure. I mean, it's on the one hand, very easy to summarize. It's about a scuba diver who's swallowed by a sperm whale and has 1 hour of air left to get out. So that's the short version. There's a lot of other things that are going on in the book, but that description is not inaccurate. Like that is,
no, it's very accurate.
That is the essential plot of the book. There's a kind of there's a major other level of the boy who was swallowed, sort of dealing with his relationship to his father, who died in those waters, and he begins to, in the stomach of the whale, he begins to sort of hallucinate maybe that the whale is his father, and so. To escape, he's going to have to try to reconcile with his dad in some ways to remember the lessons his dad taught him, which could help him escape the whale.
So before getting into like a lot of these really like these other themes, I was curious what drew you to the whales and the ocean and scuba diving. Like, is this something that you were interested in previously? I read a little bit in the back of the book. You kind of go into it a little bit, but I just wanted to hear more about like the inspiration to go into this world of aquatic horror, basically.
No, I wasn't invested in whales or the ocean or diving at all. I knew nothing about any of those things. So this is really the opposite of right what you know. I couldn't have known less. The inspiration came from a viral video of a whale sort of breaching and landing on a couple of kayakers, which lots of people have seen. Mm-hmm. And the kayakers are okay. They just sort of end up in the mouth for a second, and then they're sort of spat out, which whales generally do because they have these tiny little stomachs. I'm sorry, tiny little throats. Sperm whales, though, have giant throats. They're the only one that could, in theory, swallow somebody. So really, it was the premise that kickstarted my interest in it. And once I started interviewing whale experts to get a sense of if this was even possible, what's inside a whale? Could one live at all in there? What could one do or not do? I quickly became kind of obsessed with whales, and I still am. And people give me whale. Just today I got another whale gift. People give me whale stuff constantly.
Oh my God.
Not only do I own a week's worth of whale clothing, I've got whale mugs and whale like crochet things people have made and little whale statues. They just keep coming, but I'm okay with it because I really do. They are sort of my favorite animal now.
I can only imagine.
I was telling Terry, I was like, this book made me realize it's not just like a big old chamber. Like you think in Pinocchio or like, and yeah. Again, like it's something you don't
Pinocchio
think about
lied.
It, but you're like reading it. I was like, wait, this is really claustrophobic and there's no space. Oh my God, no, opening in a whale stomach is actually like not what you think it is. And it was.
Yeah, that was my first question. Ooh. My first question was, could someone be swallowed?
Yeah.
Question was, what's the space like? Because I had assumed that it wasn't Pinocchio, where it's like an auditorium. But I did wonder, is it something you could stand up in? Like, I didn't know anything. And it turns out it's more like a sleeping bag. an elastic sleeping bag, so it's like tight, but you could, but it's you can kind of push it with your arms and legs, so it's stretchy a little bit. So yeah, it's really about the small space you could exist in.
Have you seen the movie The Borderlands or The Final Prayer?
Are they the same movie?
Yeah, they are. They have the same title.
The Final Prayer sounds really familiar.
It's a found footage movie about a church in Ireland, and it's a church that is placed over a like burial site, and there's something to do at the end that reminds me of your book. And it was really weird. Like, I haven't really experienced that in like media in terms of digestion, and it's just very harrowing. So
I'll add that to my watch list for this month, because I don't think I've seen that.
It's really good folk horror found footage if you're a found footage person.
Yeah, sure.
The ending is one of the most fucked up things I think I've ever seen personally. So
there's nothing that'll get me to watch something faster than hearing that it has a great ending. That always seals the deal for me.
So your book wrecked my entire life, because you tapped into a very specific fear of mine. And your book is so specific in Jay's experience with his dad, but it also is very universal, because I also have not spoken to my dad in a very long time. And your book, if I start crying, I'm so sorry. this is embarrassing.
No, believe me when I say I'm kind of used to it at this point.
I know, I'm sorry.
It's really okay.
But my like biggest fear is he's going to die and everyone's going to blame me. It's not that necessarily I'm not going to get to see him, but the blame and the feelings from other people. And I've never read something or experienced something that has captured that anxiety in a way that isn't shaming you for not wanting to reconcile with your parent, because so many things are very preachy about like, you have to forgive. It's important to forgive, the power of forgiveness. And I don't really necessarily believe in that so much. And so
me neither.
Your book was so validating and so challenging for me in a really amazing way. And I mean, holy shit, what was that like for you to write this though? I mean, I can only imagine like what, going on and digging into Jay's character and his relationship with his dad and what that experience was like for you as a writer.
It has been startling to hear how many people have been affected by it, although it's more like found it relevant to specifically relevant to their lives, and I expected some of that, but not as much as I've received. So there is something, even though, yeah, like you said, it's very specific, and yet somehow there's something about it that's universal.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of it was, you know, like you're saying, a lot of it is sort of based on personal experience. And I just tried to be really emotionally open to that. You know, like I've written about this kind of relationship a couple times, like at the beginning of my career.
Okay.
But not as head on as this is. Like, I was always sort of writing around it and sort of glancing off it.
Yeah.
This was something where I just decided I liked the premise so much, and I felt like the premise was so powerful, just inherently powerful, that I wanted a relationship that felt as inherently powerful. And to me, it was, I didn't want to overthink it. You know, I just wanted to, what's the most powerful relationship that I can write right now? And I hadn't written about sort of a father son thing in 18 books or something. It had been a long time.
Okay.
So I'm just older now, and maybe wiser, and just maybe a better writer, and can just I just felt ready to tackle it and just cut right through the center of it.
Well, that was the thing. When I went into this, I was really excited because I love aquatic horror, and I'm like, the idea of being stuck in a whale stomach, I don't think you can find anything much more horrifying when you consider everything about the sea, just that idea of it. So I was very excited going into it, and I honestly was not expecting to be moved by some of the themes you explore. And one of the things that like really hit me was that like as a queer person, the relationship with the father is very rife with issues in our society sometimes, and also the idea of like masculinity and this is such a a potent theme that even though the character, I mean, there's one moment where he's like, I don't think I'm gay, but like there's, even without that, there is a sense of I guess universality with how queer people feel in those types of relationships. So I, like, for me, I was floored at how much it felt like this could be my story. Like that's what really drew me to it after I got past the fact that, oh, this is gonna be awesome because this is an aquatic horror book.
Yeah. I appreciate that. A lot of it is really about masculinity, like what Jay always feels not like enough of a man to suit his father, who's sort of a, just like my dad was, sort of a old school hunting, fishing, harvester of other creatures, in other words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That can be done in a way, and I think my dad and Mitt both do this, can be done in a way that's really sort of ecologically sound. So that's not the issue with it. The issue is that it involves a sort of rite of violence that is not for everyone. And Jay's not willing, for whatever personal convictions he has, or just his personality, just doesn't want to be part of that cycle where he's expected to sort of become the next in line of this kind of man. So that was very easy for me to dig into. Like, I didn't have to explore very deep for that. But yeah, I mean, I love your read of it. And the line you point out about him sort of like saying, I don't think I'm gay or whatever, is very intentional. You know, I want Jay, he's fighting to define himself in opposition to his dad. Like, he doesn't know what he wants to be, but he knows it's not that. And that's kind of what he's building away from.
And I also like that Jay's a 17 year old boy.
Yeah.
And you don't, it's, and I was just curious about choosing his age and having him be on the edge. And I love how he is like on the edge of manhood, whatever we want to call that, like legally becoming an adult, and kind of just curious why you chose that age for him.
Well, there's sort of two reasons. The first one will surprise you. It really had to do with the mechanics of a whale. When I was first talking to the very first of my whale experts that I interviewed, the one who told me that, someone could be swallowed by a sperm whale, he said it would have to be a really big sperm whale and a pretty small person. So immediately I thought, well, this probably isn't going to be, at the very least, a large man.
Yeah. Right.
Be someone smaller, not a child, because a child wouldn't be out diving like that. So the most obvious thing was it's a teenager. And then the second thing was really what we were talking about before. I just wanted to pair the powerful premise with something I felt strongly about. And so I put the two together and it's like, well, it's going to be a teenage boy. So part of it was really just practicality of who can fit down the throat, you know?
What a wild thing to consider. Like, all right, the mechanic, because I mean, I can only imagine, have people been like kind of bothering you about the actual mechanics of whales and trying to like scientifically disprove anything in the book to you?
I keep waiting.
Okay.
That's good.
Because I was reading the back and you were just like, to anyone who wants to complain, I took some liberties here. I'm not a scientist.
And well, in my own defense, I just to be very clear, I didn't take any liberties. There's just one whale fact that is debated. And it's probably the direction I'm going to is probably the right direction. But there's some debate about
that.
I'm very clear about it.
So do you have a favorite whale besides the sperm whale now?
No, just the sperm whale.
Just the sperm whale? Okay. So scary. Would you ever go diving with a sperm whale or with sperm whales?
Oh, boy. You know, after Peter Benchley wrote Jaws, he got all these offers to dive with sharks. And he was a diver. So he took them up on that and he did. He spent the rest of his life fighting for shark conservation. And he was always diving with sharks and going into shark cages and all this stuff. So there's part of me, my gut answer is that no, I don't want, I'm not a diver. I'm not a good swimmer. I don't intend to ever really do it again. But there's part of me that wonders, like, if National Geographic contacted me and they're like, your book. We love your book. It's so important, blah, blah, blah. Blew a lot of smoke on my butt. We got to get you in the water with the whale. I would think about it. I would think about it partially because of how much my great respect for Peter Benchley and his wife, Wendy, who really devoted their lives to such a thing. And they really were able to bring awareness to it because of who they were. So if I was ever in a position to be able to do something good by it, then I would consider it. Just me alone. I don't think so. I'm just not good in the water.
Yeah,
that's fair.
The water scares me. To be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
All right. So before we do talk about the movie that you brought, let's take it back to being a kid. How did you get introduced to the horror genre?
My mom, she was a big fan of Night of the Living Dead and Twilight Zone.
Okay.
These are two things that were on TV all the time. So, you know, back in the early days where you just watched what was on. And So I saw Twilight Zone every week. And this is starting when I was like 5 or 6 years old. Uh-huh. And Night of the Living Dead all the time. It was always on multiple times a year. And she just loved horror. And she really enjoyed those two things. Like, she wasn't sitting there like moaning in terror. She was laughing and having a good time. And so I think it made it sort of a safe space where I got to enjoy it. And then as I got older, I, you know, like a lot of us kept pushing the limit. So this would have been very classic sort of 80s VHS video store stuff where I lived in a small Iowa town, and there was one video store for most of my youth, small little place. And in the back on this little cubby, they had the horror section. And I feel like a lot of my life was created in that little 5-foot space, you know, where they just had maybe 3 cabinets of horror stuff, but it was like things were back then. It was just completely random selections of weird crap. You know, they would have your standard big budget stuff, but they'd also have Faces of Death, you know, like they just had a random sampling of whatever they happened to order. And, you know, that's where probably a lot of episodes of your show start, is in a place just like that, picking random things off the shelf and watching them with having no idea what you're about to get into. So, I mean, I could come back weekly and we could just talk about a different box on that shelf.
Yeah, I know how that is, because I was a child of the 80s. And so walking through the video store and just seeing the covers was always like such a thrill for me, or a horrifying moment for me, because there's some covers that terrified the absolute shit out of me. But I love that you grew up in Iowa. I live in Nebraska. I live in Omaha, and my parents are living in East Western Iowa. So like my that's my world.
Yeah. I mean, you're pretty isolated, and we were all sort of isolated pre-internet, but
yeah,
really isolated in a place like that. And the first taste you had of like something that you could choose, and now we can choose everything, was the sort of video stores.
Yeah.
What you could bring home. You'd probably have to rent a VCR too, since we didn't have VCR for a while. But you could actually choose which terrible tape you wanted to take home.
It was the best. Based on the cover art, it was my favorite as a kid. It was the best.
Yeah, like this to this day, and again, this is probably common on this show. To this day, I'm still picking up all the pieces of those covers. Like, I'll see a movie that pops up on Tubi or something, and I'll be like, yes, that was in that store, and I never got around to it, and today's the day.
Yep, all the time, actually. And it's like, oh, this movie was not scary at all. Like, it was not a good movie, but they always were the ones that I thought were going to be the most terrifying.
Yeah, and it's weird. A lot of the things that I would talk about on this show are movies that, in retrospect, aren't very scary. And this is probably very common, but there were elements of it that just triggered something.
What were some other options that you had that scared you as a kid that aren't?
Oh, there were so many, and some of them people had already done. Halloween 3 really scared me as a little kid. Weirdly, the movie The Stuff.
Oh, okay. Yeah. If you don't understand what the hell is going on in that movie, you're just like, the ice cream yogurt is going to eat me. Like, it's over.
So many of these like scarred for life moments are really moments. Like, sometimes there's a movie that's just horrifying from the beginning or end.
Yeah.
A lot of times it's just these isolated moments. There's a bit at near the end of the stuff with his character, Chocolate Chip Charlie, opens his mouth and it just gets wider and wider and the stuff comes out. And I remember just like almost throwing up. Like I was so horrified by that. And yeah. These things would really, really bother me. I can think of a couple other situations where I was like up in the bathroom thinking I was going to like puke. Like these things really would affect me.
Okay.
The funniest one that I didn't do, I'm not even sure you're allowed to do it on the show. It was a TV episode.
Oh, so, yeah, we could do TV.
Oh, yeah.
So I love Tales from the Dark Side as a kid.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And there was this one episode called Case of the Stubborns. And stars a very young Christian Slater.
Oh,
and,
okay.
You know, I, last year I rewatched all the Tales from the Dark Side, which I hadn't seen since I was a kid.
Oh, cool.
And because, you know, Romero produced them and, you know, I'm a fanatic. So I wanted to catch up on all this stuff because he wrote and directed a little bit too on the show. But anyway, Case of the Stubborns is not like one of the best episodes or anything like that, but it's about this guy who's dead and doesn't want to admit it, and you know, this old man, and how they eventually get him to admit it is they put pepper in his napkin and he blows his nose, and then you sort of see him from the back walk upstairs to his coffin, and then Christian Slater opens up his napkin, he's blown his nose off, and the last image of this episode is just this sort of nose with some nose guts hanging out the back. Mm. And it scared me, or it got to me so badly that for the next like couple years, at least, I was afraid to turn channels on the TV because I was afraid that I would accidentally land on that moment.
Yep. Oh. I know how that goes. That's horrifying.
And I remember one day I was turning the channels and it didn't land in that moment, but it landed on the title card of that episode. And it was like, I pretty much like threw the remote control across the room. That one stays with.
Wow. Yeah. Holy shit. Okay. Well, now that we're talking about things that have scarred you for life, what movie, Daniel, have you brought with you today for us to discuss?
I have brought 1980 something's Deadly Friend. Directed by Wes Craven.
Deadly Friend, a film that I'm so excited I finally have gotten a chance to watch. For those of you unfamiliar with this Wes Craven masterpiece, a teenage whiz kid puts his robot's brain in the head of a nearly dead girl, played by Christy Swanson. And very boy, basic synopsis.
Very basic. Very basic. Does not do it justice, but take us back. How old were you when you saw this? How did you see it? What about it terrified you? Why is this your scarred for life pick?
Well, nothing about what I'm about to tell you is going to surprise you. it would have been like when it was on HBO. So like whatever, like maybe a year after it came out. Do we have the date on this one?
It came out in 86, it looks like.
Okay, so probably 87, something like that. And at that point, I guess we must have gotten HBO. Either that or we had a free preview of it or something. Because remember, HBO used to run these free preview weekends.
Yep.
I know we went through many of those before we actually got it. So I remember like walking through the living room. A lot of my horrifying memories in life involved me just passing through the living room. And
yep.
And guess what? Who's on screen but Christy Swanson with the basketball? And I sort of pause because that in the old days, I mean, you just kept your TV on. It was just on.
Yeah.
It just like run all the time. And it was night. And I paused and I saw Christy Swanson dribbling this basketball. And what was her name? Is it Ann Ramsey?
Yeah. Ann Ramsey.
From Throw Mama from the Train and the Goonies.
The Goonies?
She's standing there and Christy Swanson rears back with the basketball and throws it and explodes Ann Ramsey's head in just a fountain of gore.
So much gore.
It's so much gore.
It was just one of those moments where it's like, I was probably in that living room for 5 seconds. I looked at it, head explosion, and just kind of like backed away. I was like, nope. And it became a moment for me that was a little bit like the Tales from the Dark Side nose, where it was like, I don't know what that is, but I don't want to see it. There's something about the weirdness of it. Like, had it been someone like you know, shooting a gun at someone, their head exploding. It would have been one thing, but there's something about it being a basketball that
just a basketball.
It's absurd enough to make you feel weird.
It's so it's like almost uncanny because you're like, it's between the basketball and like the head explosion. I, as a kid, you probably didn't notice as much, but like the head explosion looks very not real because you can tell it is practical effects. But then also just like the way she lobs it, there's everything about it is just bizarre. And it doesn't fit the movie really either. Like there's not a lot of that happening in this. And again, you hadn't seen the full movie as a kid, but it doesn't fit in this movie at all.
No, like everything involving that basketball is really shoehorned in. It's almost like it's almost like the director like really wanted this basketball scene in a movie, and this was the movie he was assigned to direct. He's like, well, we're going to work a basketball head explosion into it.
You're like, what's Craven, buddy? What were you doing, honey? Like, well, what was the Oh, tell me right
a
now.
A lot of it was studio interference.
Oh,
so he originally, Wes Craven and Bruce Joel Rubin, who wrote the screenplay based off of a novel by Diana Henstill called Friend, they wanted to make a twisted, dark romance about a boy who puts the chip into this girl and then the romance that sort of follows. But because of Wes Craven's lineage of Nightmare on Elm Street, once they did a test screening of it with a lot of his fans, they weren't happy with it because there wasn't enough gore. And so the producer said, you got to add more gore. Wes Craven and Bruce did not want to, but they were kind of forced to do some research shoots and insert more of these horrific scenes into the movie because he just wanted to tell a PG story, which would have been before. I think this would have been before PG-13 even existed, but he wanted to make like a PG movie that was basically a dark romance with some thriller aspects to get away from being shoehorned as a horror director.
I think that explains very succinctly the tonal weirdness of this movie.
Yes. Because
a lot of it does feel PG. Like it just, there's an element of it that feels like License to Drive or Goonies or something where there's just like kids running around, like being mischievous. And there's, and the robot is like, it makes these little gremlins noises like
baby. And it's just like it feels like a kid's, it feels like a coming of age kids movie. It feels like a Gremlins, like a thing like that. And it's kind of cute and a little bit fucked up because obviously she's getting abused by her father, and like their house is the refuge for Christy Swanson's character from her abusive dad. But there is like this kind of happiness to it.
Yeah.
Like a little, again, it's not Amblin-esque necessarily, but like you can tell it's trying to get the Spielberg-y vibes, but also having a little bit of a darkness to it too. Yeah.
Which
is interesting watching with him. Cause I hadn't thought about like the chronology of like where this fell in his oeuvre. And it's interesting that this is after Nightmare on Elm Street, because it feels much cuter at first. Like cuter.
But Craven was definitely somebody, and Romero falls in this camp too, where they wanted to do other stuff. Romero too also wanted to do kid stuff and wasn't allowed to. So, like, I totally buy Craven wanting to do something that was totally different for a new audience. And then I bet the whole Anne Ramsey character wasn't even in that version. And they said, we need a neighbor who we can violently kill. And so you get this weird, really jarring tonal shifts between frolicking kids and then some like really dark and gory stuff. There's three different brain surgery scenes in here that feel like unnecessary.
Yeah. And from what I understand, it sounded as if, because I had this quote from Wes Craven where he was talking about, we started off doing a picture that Warner Brothers indicated they wanted to do, a macabre love story with a twist. But about 5 weeks into the shoot, they realized who I was and told me not to be inhibited by what they had told me in the past. So the last week of shooting, I made up one little nightmare scene and put it into the film. And it was the scene that like I found to be incredibly horrifying, which is the dad leering over his daughter and then getting stabbed in his chest and the blood just gushing out everywhere, which seems, up until that moment, it seems completely out of left field.
Yeah.
And that apparently worked really well with the test screenings. And so that is what caused them to do a lot of reshoots and start adding in and upping the body count, because that scene was like, what the fuck? Cause it just, it comes out of nowhere. And I didn't know it was a dream. I should have, because of course you're coming off of the Nightmare on Elm Street and everyone's like, Wes Craven's dreams, let's add some more dreams to it. So I'm sure that's probably what happened, but it felt real in the moment until she's jabbing him. And then it's just like gushing blood. Everyone's like, okay, this is a dream. But up until that point, I was like, this is really deeply uncomfortable, because not only is it abusive, but he is leering over this young girl, and it gives very gross vibes to it that surprised the hell out of me.
Yeah, it's an uncomfortable movie.
It is an uncomfortable movie, especially because, again, like, Samantha's a young girl who is abused by her father, and with a dream, I think, all but confirms there's also other kinds of abuse. It's not just physical abuse, but there's, like, sexual abuse happening, and it's really fucked up. But then I feel like there's something about this that gives me the ick, this movie that gives me the ick a little bit. Yep. And I if it was from her perspective, I think it would have been better, but it feels like we don't really get her perspective, only in her this one dream sequence, but we don't really, this isn't her movie. And then we get her dream to kind of make her go through this really fucked up thing. And then we go back out of the dream and no longer in her perspective. And I think it's such a weird choice to make. Like, oh, we're just going to see from Samantha's perspective here when she's going through a really fucked up situation with her dad. Like,
just this once. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, like, then we see her get pushed down the stairs. So the only time we really see her when she's not the deadly friend is when she's getting abused by her dad, or she's with her friend, with Paul. And I know it's a 1980s slash movie about a girl gets a robot brain put in her. Like, I know that I should be thinking about it this critically, but it is kind of squicky when you have these abusive moments and make this movie about a young girl who was abused, who was then without her consent, turned into her neighborhood crush's toy.
Yeah, I mean,
it's just really gross. And I don't think the movie grapples with it enough for me to feel comfortable.
No, it doesn't grapple with it at all. And there is definitely a point where she's been resurrected, and you wonder for a minute there, is she going to be his like sex robot? Like,
exactly. Yeah. And like, are you going to make her fuck you? Cause I really don't know if I can watch this movie, if there's going to be any, cause they talk about her tits at the very beginning. Like, doesn't she have nice tits? And like, yeah, she does. And I'm like, ew, goddamn it. And again, I know it's the 80s, a different time, but like that tone, that one line, like, makes you think, ew, why do you want to make her why do you want to put the robot's brain in her? It just, it's all kinds of weird and like,
yeah. And that comment, it comes as they're about to meet Anne Ramsey, which makes me wonder again if it was part of that reshoot.
Yeah.
Because up until then, those two boys, their interactions have been really PG and childlike.
Yeah, exactly.
All of a sudden, out of the blue,
that's a good point.
Suddenly they're just like talking like they're 5 years older.
Yeah, because like, most of the relationship between Paul and Samantha is pretty cute. It's like they comes over like the mom. It's like they're trying to be a safe haven for her, but then it takes like this kind of weird turn that it's just really uncomfortable and kind of unlike Craven to me. I think his characters are usually, to me, a little bit much more thought through.
Yeah,
and I don't know, something about it is just like, it feels, the studio interference makes sense, but it just, something about it is just like,
I feel like I have generally enough confidence in Craven that I imagine I wouldn't have half the amount of complaints from the original script. I just don't feel like that kind of tone of ship would have even been
in a
kid's movie.
It feels like, because again, I hadn't confirmed the year when I was watching it, but I'm like, this feels like an early Craven then. Cause I know it wasn't because of like Last House on the Left, but I'm like, this doesn't feel like him. It doesn't feel like the kind of, like, yes, he makes slashers, but I think he has really good characters in his slashers. And I think he gives them more consideration than what is given to her here. And it's just like very interesting to see kind of how perhaps he was influenced, like how studios were trying to manipulate him to make things they wanted him to make.
I think any filmmaker, if you're forced to put gore scenes into your children's movie, it's not gonna work. Like, you're forcing a PG movie to suddenly be R. And you know what? Well, what troubled me when I eventually saw it, I saw it relatively soon after my traumatic introduction to it, was that the main character, the boy, was a character I knew from Little House on the Prairie. He played.
Oh yeah.
And talk about like a really squeaky clean kid show.
Right.
My family watched that movie, that show a lot. My sisters really liked it and read all the books. And I was just familiar with this kid as being, I think his name was Albert on this show. And he's just someone who exuded innocence, and then he started transported here, and he has this goofy robot. I mean, it's basically what this movie is really, is it's Doogie Howser Frankenstein, right?
Yes. Yes. Oh my God, I actually, that is exactly I literally what wrote that down as my note.
Yeah.
Did you really?
Yes, I did.
He's a brilliant, I don't know what he is, a surgeon? Surgeon in training? But what he's really doing is he's making a Frankenstein, right? Like he's mm-hmm. got, there's a dead body. Like technically Kirsty Swanson is dead.
Yeah.
And instead of giving her like a stolen graveyard brain, he gives her a robot brain. And then what ensues after that makes absolutely no sense whatsoever.
No sense.
All of a sudden she becomes BB and she holds her hands like this. And yeah. He just becomes the robot. So then it's like, wait, did you want to fuck your robot? Again, I don't think there's anything more deeper than that, but just the fact that, and then when she's, her vision is pixelated like the robot's, like, and then the ending where the robot is coming out of her flesh prison.
Yeah.
And that's not really clear if that's I'm assuming that was definitely not the original ending. There's no fucking way that was an original ending. That is such like a slasher movie ending of like, yeah. It's alive.
And I actually really liked that moment. Like that was a cool horror movie.
It was cool.
It was a cool horror movie moment. Cool. And apparently a 1990 interview with Fangoria, Bruce Joel Rubin said about the ending and why it stayed in the film, that robot coming out of the girl's head belongs solely to Mark Canton. And you don't tell the president of Warner Brothers this idea stinks.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
And so that's how that kind of got added to the movie. But I will say that that is it's quite an ending. It definitely will linger in your head. Cause I was like, wow, this is in a movie that keeps taking turns. This is quite a turn. And I wanted to know if it was like a joke ending. Like it was a nightmare type of thing, but it doesn't even end on that. It ends on his hearing his neck snap and it's the end. And I'm like, okay, so it feels like a nightmare, but is it real? Like it's such a weird, bizarre ending, but boy, does it linger.
Yeah. To go back to the robot brain for a second, just to
yes.
sort of clear the air here. Like, clearly at some point, like she was going to have the robot brain. And when they got to shooting that scene of her now with the robot brain, they suddenly had to deal with, well, what is a human being with a robot brain? What do they act like? And they never came up with a better answer than she walks like she's doing the robot, like a robot dance. Like, why would you hold your arms out stiff? Why would you have pixelated vision if you still have flesh and blood eyes? Why would you suddenly be super strong? Your body is just a human corpse body. Why are you suddenly jumping over walls and like throwing people across the house? Like, none of this makes any sense.
Flying out of the attic.
Lack of control of the vocal cords and only speaks like BB, and then she can. It's just like the opposite of all like cyborg movies. I feel like we see it is just like so. What, like you just put a chip in her head, and it just worked out that way. Okay, dude, fine, I guess.
And why I don't see why he even kept her alive, because she's just the robot. Like, she's not Kirsty. You haven't saved Kirsty Swanson. You've saved her corpse. Her corpse is being animated like a puppet.
I would have loved it if her body started falling apart. You know what I mean?
Yes, because
he was like, she's cold. She's not. It's not like he's operating her organs. It's like he's just, again, now I'm thinking too hard about it. And it's just, it's so goofy. It's so goofy.
If you really played out the logic of it, it could be a really great fucked up adult horror film. Like,
it could be though.
Like, the body starts rotting and you'd have to make the character really, you know, quite insane. And the movie kind of seems to want to have it both ways, with having Doogie Howser Frankenstein be both insane in some ways, but really likable in others. But it just what he's doing is horrible.
Runs his really mom like a lot of drugs in her coffee at one point, so he won't, so she doesn't know that they're going to steal her body from the morgue and bring it back to life. Like, they are grave robbing. And then he has the balls to punch his friend in the nose at the end and be like, how dare you? And his friend is like, who are you, dude? You just moved here. You're implicating me in all these crimes. Don't punch me.
Yeah. He's this Doogie Howser guy is like, he's horrible.
He really is
mentally unbalanced.
But I love Tom because he keeps like passing out in this movie. And there's the moment when he like is riding up on his bike at the end. And I think it was when they're taking the bodies out and he like literally falls off his bike. And I was like, okay, I love that this is happening. And I love how goofy this character played by Michael Sherritt is. I love his performance. It's so bizarre, and it definitely feels like everyone is acting in a completely different movie. We have Christy Swanson being a robot, but also looking like a zombie. We have Doogie Howser, and then we have Tom, who is just like this golly gee, I'm gonna faint at the sight of blood type of character. And it just, I don't know, for some reason, their little trio worked for me, even though the story is really kind of horrific and fucked up from a Doogie Howser Frankenstein perspective. But yet, I don't know, there's something about the relationship that was like, this is kind of interesting.
Everything you said is true. And I do want to state kind of for the record that I found this totally watchable. Like, it is, it is so bonkers and heading in so many different directions at once that it kind of has to be seen. Like,
you
have to be watched to be believed.
It's, you see the gif on Twitter all the time of the head explosion and you're like, what could this movie possibly fucking be? And I finally got to experience what this movie is because this is the first time I watched it. And I can't say I'm disappointed. At least the madness is like most of the movie. It's totally insane and makes no sense. But like, hey, it's cool. It's weird that it exists and Wes Craven directed it of all people, not some random nobody, Wes Craven. After Nightmare on Elm Street.
Oh, speaking of, did you notice that there's a the dad who is a confirmed pretty much child molester ends up getting burned with his flesh all.
Oh fuck! I didn't even think about that.
So it's basically almost a Freddy Krueger origin story, because that's exactly.
And he comes out of the bed. He comes out of the bed.
It's exactly how Freddy Krueger was made, I guess you could say. So all I'm saying is, this is canon Nightmare on Elm Street.
This is the true story.
Freddy Krueger murdered his daughter and she got turned into a weird robot by the creepy boy next door.
Yeah, this is the prequel to Nightmare on Elm Street. Really weird prequel.
All right, everybody. I want to direct a prequel where it is combining Deadly Friend and Nightmare on Elm Street to make this canon. We are doing it. It is happening. I cannot wait.
But I am curious, Daniel. So you saw that scene on TV and then you said you saw it in its entirety a little bit later. What did you think when you finally sat down to watch the whole thing? Do you remember if it bothered you at all?
I mean, I think anyone who sees that the gif of the basketball head and then sees the movie will be as bewildered as they were before, because it has no bearing on the movie. Like, you don't watch the basketball head scene and think, oh, I bet this is about a robot. You know, but at around this time I was a really big Nightmare on Elm Street fan, so I really got in around the time of Dream Warriors. I feel like I might have been in like fifth grade or somewhere in that neighborhood. And I became really fanatical about Freddy Krueger. And so I can't confirm this, but maybe saw that it was a Wes Craven movie. How much I was aware of directors and their catalog, I'm not really sure. But either I watched it because it was a Wes Craven movie, or I watched it because I did have a tendency to purposely watch things that I knew would scare me. And sometimes it would backfire terribly and I'd be dry heaving after this stuff. So I watched it and it was a long time ago. So I'm stretching a little bit, but I'm sure I was very puzzled by it, and probably back then less aware of how tonally totally weird and kind of unique it was, and more just like people of the time, which were probably just sort of disappointed in it. Kind of what you wanted.
It didn't do well.
Oh, I'm sure. Well, like at that age and that time, what you kind of wanted from slashers, if you're a fifth grade kid, is you want naked teenagers, you want the gore. Mm-hmm. And this featured none of the former and some of the latter in impressive moments, which I think still probably made it kind of pay off. Like it's not like I watched it and forgot about it. Like I watched it and I remember watching it because you aren't expecting, because of the childlike nature of it, the gory stuff that happened. So it didn't, right. It didn't become a favorite of mine or anything like that, but I remembered it.
And it's so weird. Cause I'm a huge Wes Craven fan. And I was, as a kid, Freddy was my go-to. One of the few movies I owned was Nightmare on Elm Street 4 on a beta tape. Like that was like my prized possession. And I would wear that shit out because I loved Freddy. I loved Wes Craven's movies, his original movie. But I didn't even know that this existed. When you had suggested it, I was like, Deadly Friend, what is that? And I looked it up. I was like, this is a Wes Craven film? For some reason, has completely escaped my knowledge. So I was really excited to actually sit down and watch this mid-80s version of Wes Craven when he was like coming off of, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street and all that. It's just, it's wild to me. And I was when I was sitting down to watch it last night, I was like 45 minutes in and was like, where does all the killing happen? Because other than the one dream with the, you know, the piercing through the stomach, there's not a whole lot until we get to the last half of the movie when she has become the robot. I didn't realize how long it was going to take for us to get to that moment. I expected it. First act, she's dead. Second act, you know, we do all the killing. Third act, we have to resolve it. But it's like the midpoint of the movie almost is where she finally gets transformed into a robot. And I was like, this is fascinating from a structural perspective, because then it does literally turn into a slasher. And that's when I was like, what happened with this movie? And I had to go down the rabbit hole. But what a wild time.
The wild experience. And we did it together.
Goes from madcap shenanigans to
madcap shenanigans.
Like sex robot death march.
Honestly, I would watch a movie called Sex Robot Death March.
Yeah, it sounds pretty.
That sounds great. Honestly, I'm fucked up enough, but I would watch like an adult version of this where like a Frankenstein type guy makes a fuck doll and it's like falling apart and he's trying to figure. Terry, shut up. You know I would watch that. I would make that movie. Are you fucking kidding me? Maybe I'll make it.
Like, honestly, that sounds good. Like, I really like those kind of absurd scenarios that have some real viscerality to them. Like I would seriously read or watch that. Like that sounds like there's something there.
I want to see Poor Things, which is the Yorgos Lanthimos Frankenstein, which might be, I don't know if it's the exact same, but it's horny Frankenstein with Emma Stone as the monster. Right. So anyway, do we want to wrap this up and give this our rating out of 5?
That sounds good.
We're all going to give the rating.
We're all going to, yep. You're last. You get the final word.
Good, because I need to get a sense of how this goes.
Yeah. All right. So Terry, you're up first. How many dramatically exploding heads out of 5 do you give Deadly Friend?
You know, one of my favorite things about that moment, though, is the fact that, yes, I've seen the GIF of the head exploding, but then the body is moving around like a chicken without its head for a good 5 seconds. And I was like, wow.
That's worse.
Yeah, because I was waiting for the head. To explode because I'd seen the GIF. And then I was like, whoa, this thing just continues. Watching this made me realize that not only was Anne Ramsey born in Omaha, Nebraska, but she is interred here in the cemetery in Omaha, Nebraska.
Oh my God. And I'm like, pay her a visit.
That's wild.
You know, what you should do is dig her up, put a robot brain in her.
She's back.
And I have Mama Fratelli as a robot.
Oh my God.
I love that.
Please.
But I did not know what to expect of this movie. It definitely gave me whiplash at the tones. But I have to say that it is, as you said, Daniel, it is eminently watchable. And it's bonkers. And I had a good time with it. I think I enjoyed the last half surprisingly more than the first half. But what a wild movie. very clunky in spots. Definitely can tell studio interference. But for me, I had a good time with it, and I definitely would bring this movie out with a bunch of friends, get some, you know, drinks going, and just have a blast with it. So for me, I'm going to give it three dramatically exploding heads. I think it's a fun time. What about you, Mary Beth?
Yeah, I think I agree. I think I'm going to give it three. I was going for a two before the conversation, but I was like, all right, I appreciate it for what it is. And I just love when like huge filmmakers like Wes Craven have these kinds of movies just like in the middle of their filmography, not even the beginning, like it's in the middle. And I love that. We all can make weird shit, and that's okay. And I just, you know, sometimes you need to, as a creative, know that sometimes you make weird shit and it might not be the best thing you've ever made, but you still made it and you made something after it. So your career isn't over. That's a weird mind space I'm in right now. Anyway, but yeah, that's the three dramatically exploding heads for a deadly friend for me. But then, Daniel, you have the final word. How many exploding heads out of five?
I'm going to rate this not based on sort of, you know, Academy of Motion Pictures quality, but just sort of based on what if I owned this, would I watch it again? And it's a resounding yes.
Yeah.
I think I had an absolute ball with this, and I'm a sucker for things that are tonally off. And usually you get those from filmmakers who don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And there's an inherent sort of forgiveness you give to that because they're new at it. And sometimes when you don't know what you're doing, it makes fascinating missteps that reveal something sort of new. This is not that, but the end product is similar. And squickiness aside, I kind of love it. And so I'm going to give it four dramatically exploding heads.
Oh, hell yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Daniel, for joining us and getting me to watch this movie. Where can our listeners find you online? And the floor is yours to plug away.
Well, danielcross.com is my internet online website. And that kind of has, I just like to send people there because I don't know what's going to happen with any other social media.
Who knows?
So go there and it'll send you off to other places if those places still exist. And I don't have anything else to plug. Just Whale Fall. I don't have another adult novel until next fall. So we'll just play it close to the chest until then.
Wait,
are they making it into a movie?
Yeah. That's supposed to happen.
Hell yeah. Congrats.
That's going to give me nightmares. I can't wait. listeners, you've heard from us. We want to hear from you. What was your experience with Wes Craven's Deadly Friend? Send us an email at scarredforlifepodcast@gmail.com or reach out to us on social media. I am at MB McAndrews on Twitter and Blue Sky, and I'm at MB.McAndrews on Instagram.
And I'm at Gailey Dreadful everywhere.
And of course, don't forget to follow the podcast everywhere. You can follow us on Twitter and Blue Sky at Scarred Podcast, and then on Instagram at Scarred for Life Podcast.
And please don't forget to review, rate, and subscribe. And if you want to help support us, we do have a Patreon.
Thank you to Eric Power for our artwork. Thank you to Sean Keller for our music. Thank you everyone for listening. Please stay safe out there, but most importantly, stay creepy.
And until next time.